Thanks for joining us this morning. I want to wish Sheriff Mark Napier a happy birthday and take the day off. I said it's okay. I want everybody to check out our website too, lawmatters1030.org. And if you click on the logo in the upper left-hand corner, it'll take you to the GoFundMe page. We're trying to help TPD's canine unit get some equipment that they need. And the story of why we're doing this is on that page. So if you're curious enough, go check it out and maybe contribute to the cause. Our guest today is Jim Reed. He's legal counsel for former federal agent Jay Dobbins, whose job embedded him with the Hells Angels. I know I read the book, and I've talked to several people who've read the book, but not everybody knows the story behind this case. And Jim, I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Good morning, Sherry.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Doing okay. Just to set up the case, because this is a long, I think it's still going on, long legal battle, can you explain to everybody the story behind this?
Well, it's a legal battle that's coming to an end. In 2006, I met Jay Dobbins, who was an ATF agent at the time, and he had an exciting life opportunity in selling his life rights to 20th Century Fox Studios for a film about his undercover infiltration of the Hells Angels. Jay and I worked together on that successfully, and then I became his personal counsel for employment disputes he had with the agency. Those disputes related to the fallout from his investigation of the Hells Angels from 2002 to 2004, and then he had a series of death threats and violence threats against not just himself, but his wife and his daughter from 2003 to 2006. A settlement agreement due to ATF's lack of response to those threats was signed in September of 2007, and then rather than abide by the agreement, ATF shortly thereafter withdrew Jay's two dozen fictitious identification documents that ultimately disclosed even his home address. And in August of 2008, his home was set on fire in the middle of the night. Jay was up taking flight training classes in Phoenix at the time, and Pima County Sheriff's Office records indicate that the home was under some level of surveillance by more than one criminal element for the couple of weeks leading up to that. They knew when he wouldn't be there. Jay's wife and children escaped, and we filed suit for breach of contract against ATF.
Wow. Okay. So he was taking flight lessons. Is Jay a pilot?
You know, I don't know what the status of Jay's license is at the time, but I honestly have a lot of pilot friends in Arizona. My last law firm had an airplane, and it's a great thing to do in Arizona. It's a great thing to see the state, and I think, frankly, after Operation Black Biscuit, Jay needed to decompress a little bit, and being up in the air is a great way to do it, and his wife and his kids really encouraged it, and I think he also viewed it as a way to show them, you know, an exciting part of life in contrast to what they'd also had to endure during Operation Black Biscuit, as you know, Sherry, from reading the book.
Yeah, I can't imagine. And while I was reading the book, and I've had people say to me, how could you put yourself in that man's shoes and understand everything that was going on? He was doing a very, very dangerous job. And well, you know,
yeah, there's no question. And I think a part of the lawsuit, and I don't mean to interrupt, but part of the lawsuit is expecting that your agency is going to support you when you do dangerous work. And that was where a lot of our disappointment came from in the lawsuit.
Well, I was reading through the briefs that you sent over. There was 21 incidences of breach with the ATF. Can you go through those? Can you explain some of these?
You know, rather than go through them item by item, because what I sent to you was an exhibit that we put up at closing argument, what I thought I would do is just sort of characterize from Judge Allegra's trial court opinion or read from it, you know, his ultimate conclusions. And, you know, there we did win a three-week trial in June and July of 2013, and Judge Allegra found that ATF had breached the covenant of good faith and fair dealing in the settlement agreement from September of 2007. And there were two main elements of those breaches of the covenant. The first is the withdrawal of Jay's and his wife's fictitious identifications, which exposed their names, their vehicle information, their home address. And the second was the way they responded to the arson itself. And Judge Allegra wrote that at the time, William Newell was a special agent in charge of ATF's Phoenix Field Division. George Gillette was the assistant special agent in charge, and Charles Higman was the Tucson group supervisor. Gillette and Higman were the ones in charge of the investigation. Newell was de facto in charge, but we're honestly never sure how much he really understood what was going on, and therein lies a huge part of the problem. He was supposed to be in charge, he just didn't do the work, didn't show up in terms of running this thing. So Judge Allegra wrote, the evidence showed that ASAC, Gillette, and Agent Higman knew that Agent Dobbins was not responsible for the fire and still allowed him to be treated as a suspect as a form of payback. Moreover, ATF officials knew or should have known that individuals like ASAC, Gillette, and Agent Higman should not have been allowed to participate in the investigation. As it turned out, their conduct was not only reprehensible, but predictably so. In donning blinders in this regard, ATF officials compounded the potential harm that might have befallen the Dobbins family. That really kind of sums up the 21 breaches we put up at closing argument.
What was the reason for these people to misrepresent this investigation? Was it personal? I just didn't get that part of it.
You know, I would like to attribute 100% intentionality to what they did, but it's hard to discount the incompetence factor when you look at Newell, when you look at George Gillette, when you look at Charles Higman. They didn't seem to know how to do their jobs or how to run an investigation. And the same should be said for the FBI Phoenix Field Division when they took over the investigation in 2008. They just didn't seem to know how to go and interview people and investigate things. But beyond that, as Judge Allegra said at closing argument, he felt that the reason for the payback was some form of spite, professional jealousy, just plain meanness. It is stunning that not only did they put Jay Dobbins in harm's way, but he had children who I believe were ages 12 and 14 or so at the time.
Wow.
And what, you know, as an outsider to law enforcement, I expected after I heard about the arson that there were going to be 50 agents at the site, that no matter what, Jay is larger than life. And I think there's just a lot of professional jealousy and pettiness about agents who just either, you know, did a bad job or just pushed paper, wanted to be like Jay but just weren't like him. So I thought 50 agents would be on the site. Instead, the day of the arson, August 10th, 2008, no one from ATF showed up at all. And that's an official finding by a federal judge.
And the fire happened here in Tucson, or is it outside of Tucson?
It was in Pima County. I'm not going to say exactly where it was,
no.
But it was not subject to Tucson PD jurisdiction. It was Pima County Sheriff's Office.
Okay, I'm going through the 21 instances because I wrote notes on it, and now I understand why it's formatted the way it is. It's an exhibit. I printed it all out. Okay, it says that Charles Higman improperly required case agents to submit investigation reports in non-Enforce white paper form. What does that mean?
Well, Enforce is a system of tracking information that all agents, anyone with access to the investigative file, can look up that information, including at headquarters in Washington, D.C. And so if you're going to mishandle the investigation, if you want to cover things up, you want to keep documents out of Enforce. And so what that, as Judge Allegra indicated, that team, Gillette, Higman, and two very, very young, inexperienced, and agents who shouldn't have been there, case agents, they took white papers and they put them over at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base in a file, or at least they had the file cabinet set up to do so that no one at ATF headquarters could know what was going on. And even when senior officials like Carson Carroll came out to the site to talk with Higman, there were a number of communications back and forth between Gillette and Higman as to how they were going to withhold information from Carson Carroll. And, you know, people say, you know, don't put in a memo anything that you don't want to show up on the front page of the newspaper the next day.
True that.
Email's the same version of that. And I think Judge Allegra was just so shocked by an email that George Gillette wrote right before Carson Carroll came from Washington, D.C. headquarters, that he put it right in the opinion. I just have to share it with you.
Okay.
Can I do that?
Absolutely.
Okay, so this is in the opinion at page 17. At 4:02 p.m. on the same day, ASAC Gillette replied to Agent Higman, stating in an email, "That being said, it's not possible in this lifetime to control the director, deputy director, assistant directors, or so on down the chain from getting briefed on this case or contacting the homeowner or his family. However, what I can control and fully intend to control is the specific information that is briefed to the chain of command. I'll shoot straight. I think you could tell during our meeting on Tuesday, I am no more happy about these circumstances than you. However, like you, I've been ordered to proceed down this investigative path, so I will. What I won't do is compromise my integrity or the integrity of this investigation. I stand with you and your agents on this, so not releasing significant details to anyone that we may discover that would compromise our work won't come from me. I'll go out of my way to conceal them. Please trust that, and for the record, I am not inferring anything from your prior comments. I have enough law enforcement and intelligence community experience to know how to protect myself and my subordinates. I can hide the ball with the best of them. I have said it before, but for the record and probably future disclosure in court," and he was right on that, "I'll say it again. I fully intend that this is the last stop on the career path of George Gillette, but this case likely guarantees it." Now, there's two things I want to say about that very quickly.
Okay.
What was he hiding? Well, he was hiding that they were pursuing Jay Dobbins as the suspect after senior case agents like Tristan Moreland and Mike Hildick had said Jay Dobbins and his family had nothing to do with this investigation. We have some pretty good ideas who did this, or at least who the lead suspect should be. Let us go after them. Now, this is the first few days after the investigation, when evidence is hot, when video surveillance cameras at local gas stations are still going to have footage of a white van in the area that was had to gas up somewhere. What did George Gillette do? A couple of weeks later, he fired him off the case and put two newbie agents in. And in the interim, didn't deal with them, but put two young agents in who just did not know what they were doing or how to handle the case. The second thing that I have to say about this is that George Gillette would not voluntarily appear at trial. And the trial opinion makes clear that Gillette was hiding in Tennessee during the trial to evade our process server. And Judge Allegra had to threaten to have federal marshals go out and put Gillette in shackles and drag him onto an airplane out to trial in Washington, D.C. And that was the only way that Gillette appeared voluntarily.
That doesn't sound too voluntary to me.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well said.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a few. Okay, we're back. Our guest today is Jim Reed, who's legal counsel for Jay Dobbins, former federal agent. You said that some papers or reports were hidden at Davis-Monthan. Wouldn't that indicate that somebody at Davis-Monthan had access to this or was involved?
You know, I honestly don't know. We never could tell if any documents made their way over there. I'm not pointing out Davis-Monthan as a site for document retention to cast aspersions on that base. Somebody knew somebody over there and got access to some file cabinet space. You know, ultimately, not much in the form of white papers were produced because George Gillette and Charles Higman had a strategy of what was called a slow roll of the file. No one really did anything. And one of the things that they made Hildick and Moreland do was enter their reports at Gillette's desk. So those did, I believe, ultimately go into EnForce, but only because Tristan Moreland and Mike Hildick just put their foot down and said to Gillette, you know, whatever you're doing here, you know, the fish stinks from the head down.
That's true. Do you think they didn't go after the real people who should have been investigated because they're afraid of the Hells Angels?
No, I don't think that had anything to do with it. No. I think this was a focus entirely based on both a dislike for Jay and just a lack of concern for him. And, you know, as somebody from the outside, I don't know how professional competitiveness works in the law enforcement ranks. And, you know, at first you could say, well, right after the settlement agreement, they pulled his fictitious IDs to put their thumb in Jay's eye and didn't really mean any harm, but they knew that would bother him. Well, after then all this rolls out and there's a fire, there's a couple of thoughts a normal person like me has, and that is, that's the point where the games have to stop. And you have to say, you know, an agent's life is at stake, his family's lives are at stake, we have to respond, wash all the rest of that stuff, now let's do the right thing. They didn't do that. They doubled down. And I think a part of this, you know, my belief, one, I don't know that we're ever able to establish a trial, but that they knew that they had made it easier for criminal investigative elements to find the house. And in fact, in response to our what are called requests for admissions that you submit in writing, which we did very early in the case, right after the lawsuit was filed, Jay came up to my office in Phoenix, and we just sat there for about 5 hours and typed out 150 requests for admissions. They, ATF's DOJ representative attorneys, admitted that they made it easier for Jay's home to be found by putting his information about his home address out in the public domain, by withdrawing protections for his vehicle registration, his driver's licenses. When you have fictitious identifications, you have different, you have credit cards and bank accounts, which allow you to protect the way that you pay your power bill. All these kinds of things that hide a home address. And the Department of Justice fully acknowledged in those RFA responses that by withdrawing the fictitious IDs, it was easier for criminals to find Jay and his family. Once they knew they had done that, I think they just doubled down. And they didn't want to find real criminals who had set fire to Jay's home, because if they found those real criminals, they might just prove that the reason that Jay's home was found was because they withdrew his fictitious identifications. And then that barn door is wide open to so many different things.
Oh, yeah, you can't unring the bell. I can't imagine why any undercover person who has had to use a different ID for whatever reason would ever have that ID removed. For his personal safety reasons, safety of his family.
Well,
it makes no sense.
Two things on that. Number one, that is, and you have the list of the 21 breach arguments we made at closing. That is one of the arguments we made, that it had never happened before. Secondly, in 2012 and 2013, in response to complaints that Jay had made, ATF's Internal Affairs Division opened an investigation into two issues. Number one, was it appropriate to withdraw the fictitious identifications? And number two, did ATF properly respond to the arson? There was, inverting those, October 11, 2012 is the date of the report regarding the arson response. Something like May 13, 2013 is the date of the IAD report on the fictitious identifications. That second report found that in no other instance had ATF withdrawn the fictitious identifications that were issued post-investigation to protect the safety and location of an ATF agent. With J. Dobbins, this was the first time they did it. And they also did it in the face of at least a half dozen death and violence threats that were so credible and so valid that in the few months before they started withdrawing those fictitious IDs, Operation Security had issued a report saying that Jay was still at critical risk. And the Office of Special Counsel in June of 2009 finished their report reviewing the half dozen investigative threats and investigative related threats, and sent a letter to the President Obama saying, we have concluded these were valid, credible threats, and that ATF completely mishandled the responses to them and therefore exposed Jay to danger and his family to danger.
What, did they get a response from President Obama?
No. They did not get a response from Attorney General Eric Holder. This was, of course, consistent with how the administration was handling other ATF investigations, such as Fast and Furious. And in fact, as Jay has said in the past, if anyone, if ATF, if the Department of Justice had listened to him about William Newell and George Gillette, Fast and Furious wouldn't have happened, because he was complaining about them prior to the gunwalking episodes.
So they just had a couple of bad actors in the position of power.
At ATF?
Yes.
That's not our position. Our position is that this goes much more broadly than that, that there were people in ATF's headquarters who had enough information to follow up and act on it who did not. There were people at ATF who had the Internal Affairs Division reports in their hands and did nothing with them. The Professional Review Board issued recommendations that George Gillette and William Newell's employment should be terminated, and that is in the opinion by Judge Allegra. And nevertheless, George Gillette was allowed to retire with full benefits. William Newell kept his job, although, as the court says, albeit in a different position, and the timing of certain agreements, apparently where he kept his job, were suspect. This is a disconnect between the white-collar elements in ATF and maybe all of federal law enforcement and the field agents, the agents out there doing undercover work, in senior investigative agents, a complete disconnect. And the sad thing about it is outstanding agents, including the Internal Affairs Division investigator, Chris Traynor, who was in charge of the two IAD reports, they've left ATF. They have had it. And in so many ways, now there's a young crew of new agents, field agents, who are great, and Jay's always going to stand by field agents, but so much of ATF is hollowed out because, you know, the Washington, D.C. group of senior leadership has just lost the meaning.
Well, okay. I'm kind of curious. I know you and Jay had a lawsuit against ATF. Have any personal lawsuits against these agents that are, some are still there and some are not, have any other lawsuits gone against them as individuals?
Well, not by us. Jay kept his focus on ATF as an institution, and frankly, the work that, or lack of it, that a lot of these agents were doing was within the course and scope of their employment. So it's hard to make out a case for individual liability against any of them. And at the end of the day, what does that really get you? Jay wasn't trying to personalize this. He was saying, as an institution, ATF senior management had lost their way. And frankly, so had the FBI. When Director Mueller was in charge of the FBI, Jay appealed to him directly and said, you know, your FBI took over this investigation in September of 2008. It has done, per depositions, less than nothing with it. It hasn't interviewed anyone. It hasn't done any investigative findings. The testimony of the agent who testified at the trial was, frankly, tragic in terms of what was done to pursue the investigation. Part of that is because, as Judge Allegra found, at the point of handoff, Charles Higman told the FBI that Jay Dobbins was the prime suspect. Again, even after he had been cleared and Jay had given to Carson Carroll at ATF and other ATF representatives a list of suspects who should be pursued, including the sources of the half dozen or so death and violence threats that had been issued to him, against him, leading up to the arson.
What made them think that Jay was responsible for the arson? That's ludicrous. Yeah. You'd burn your own house down with your wife and kids in it?
Nothing made them believe that he was responsible. This was the intensity of the dislike. If I could quickly, you know, it's a 55-page opinion, so yeah, it's hard to quickly get to anything in this. But there is a footnote where Charles Higman, as the court said, in a rare unguarded moment, admitted that that Jay was just not a popular person at ATF, and that the other group supervisor in Tucson wasn't even contacted to head over and respond to the arson scene because he didn't like Jay. Now, what in the world? You know, there's a criminal arson scene, and it's one of your own who's had his house burned down, and because you've got intra-agency rivalries, you don't go? It's footnote 20. At trial, Agent Higman, in a rare unguarded moment, admitted that he viewed Jay Dobbins as being a polarizing figure, adding that there were a number of people who had very strong positive feelings for Jay and others who didn't care for Jay. And at the end of the day, in my opinion, in Jay's opinion, that's what this is all about. They just didn't like him, and so they put Jay and his family in danger, and they didn't follow up on the arson as a result. And the only way out of the mess they had created by withdrawing his fictitious identifications, and 4 months later, when that withdrawal is complete in April of 2008, his house is burned down, the only way out of having any responsibility for that is if they take the position that Jay did it, as ludicrous and absurd as that is. And Sherry, very quickly, for your audience members who don't know Jay, I'll just quote from page 5 of the opinion. As a result of his work on Operation Black Biscuit, as well as on other investigations, Agent Dobbins received 12 ATF Special Act Awards, 2 ATF Gold Stars for critical injuries received during investigative operations, an ATF Distinguished Service Medal for Outstanding Investigative Accomplishment, and the United States Attorney's Medal of Valor Award. That is not someone who sets his house on fire.
No, it sure isn't. And it's really disappointing because, you know, you always think of law enforcement, regardless of the agency, they might poke fun at each other. But when, you know, push comes to shove, it's a brotherhood. They stick together. You don't have to like the guy, but they're one of your family members. And to hear that something like this happened, and on such a huge scale, what he did was really, really dangerous. And there didn't seem to be any gratitude there.
Far to the contrary. ATF put him out on America's Most Wanted, receiving the Top Cop Award from the National Association of Police Officers for Black Biscuit. That was their idea. He received that award, was on national television, and the response was not, hey, thank you for the great stuff that you're doing on behalf of our agency, rescuing our reputation a little bit from some highly publicized investigations that didn't go well. Instead of that, they just got jealous, and you had agents saying, well, you know, I could have done that, or I did other stuff that didn't get attention, or you had, much worse, as Jay says, agents, white-collar supervisors back in D.C., who, despite having two or three levels of intrusion protection from the street, are sitting there with their gun holstered on their hip. These people had really never done it out in the field as an agent. Some of them had and had elevated up. Many others had not, and they were jealous of Jay. They were not appreciative at all. And it's too bad because Jay, he really deep down wanted to be a role model for who an ATF agent ought to be out in the public eye on behalf of ATF. He was absolutely willing to do that PR for them and was doing it at first. But, you know, frankly, the media really likes him. He's an articulate guy. He gets to the point. He has an incredible resume. And after a while, thanks, Jay, turns into, you know what? We'll get back to you when we can on that threat that you talked about. Let's see what we can do. And then they don't.
Wow. Okay. We're going to take another quick break. We'll be back in a few. Thanks for staying with us. Our guest today is Jim Reed, who's legal counsel for former federal agent Jay Dobbins. And I want to ask, have any of the Hells Angels been arrested and held accountable for this fire?
Well, no. Certainly, because they weren't investigated.
Even after all this, nobody bothered to, you know, do some research and investigate who really was involved.
Yeah, you know, some of this stuff is under seal. Some of it is specifically described in Judge Allegra's opinion. And let me be very clear here. We're not saying that the Hells Angels set fire to Jay Dobbins' house. We're not saying who did it at all. We don't know. We don't have those facts. What you do in law enforcement, as you know, Sherry, because you've been now dealing with so many agents, state and federal, you gather a list of suspects. You figure out motivations. You figure out who a credible threat is by who has the ability to carry out threats, who has ability to act on those motivations. And in the course of his career, Jay had something like 500 undercover operations. He put a lot of people in prison. Any one of those individuals, whether they're in prison or not, whether they can do it directly or they can do it through cohorts or outside prison, has a desire to do harm to Jay and his family. So we're not saying the Hells Angels did. We don't know. But, you know, more's to pity when you have a good list of credible suspects and you don't do anything about it.
True. That's really a sad situation. I'm just in awe. I'm a mortgage loan officer, and I know when I've done mortgage loans for special agents, and there is a process that you go through. It isn't just like doing a mortgage loan for your neighbor who's, you know, works at Walmart. So, you know, that there's things that are in place for their protection and your protection, and I just can't believe that they would just so egregiously ignore all this and create such a false narrative to cover their butts.
Yeah, we thought once the Internal Affairs Division reports came out, which were epic. I mean, they are stunning in the detail of the findings. And Judge Allegra made a point of saying that these IAD reports are hundreds of pages long. Chris Traynor did a stunning job in going through emails, interviewing witnesses. These reports were so devastating that Department of Justice didn't want to release them to us. And only after we made a demand for the documents, and we said we're going to move for sanctions against you. And I emailed to a number two or number three DOJ official who was he was senior counsel on this thing, but never showed up, Stuart Delery. And I said, you know what? Shame on you. I know people who know you. I know people who, when you were a Supreme Court justice clerk, were a Supreme Court justice clerk alongside of you. And they say you're better than this. And right now, I'm not seeing it. I want to see these IAD reports, which DOJ refuses to let us see. So the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Arizona said, emailed a day or two after that and said, you can come down and look at them, but you can't take any notes. So I sat in a room with a desk and two chairs while an assistant U.S. attorney sat watching me to make sure I did not take any notes. And I opened up the report, and the first two pages of it were, this was the October 11, 2012 report on the arson investigation. The first two pages were just the conclusions. And these conclusions are so amazing in the incompetence and the intentional endangerment that they described and the failure to follow up on the arson that within 45 seconds, I knew that we had a critical document that could win the trial for us. And I had a whole hour. And so I just knew I was going to make that U.S. attorney sit there for a whole hour in the uncomfortable chair because I made them give up the good chair behind the desk. And, you know, when I got back out on the street, I called Jay and said, you know, we got these guys. And not only that, once DOJ and ATF sees how great this is, they're going to do something to people. Heads are going to roll with Higman, Gillette, Newell, and others who were so incompetent. Nothing happened. Not a thing happened to these people. And I will say that Jay worked very hard explaining the history of this, because you call it a narrative, and you're right, that they were building this false narrative. Jay worked very hard with Chris Traynor to explain the narrative as he saw it. And Jay, as a prosecuting agent, is very detail-oriented, produced documents, emails he got from the Freedom of Information Act, including that Gillette email, which if ATF had any idea what they were looking at, I don't think we would have ever seen it. And DOJ, ATF were just not interested in holding any of these people accountable.
Speaking of Jay, he's on the phone. Good morning, Jay.
Hi, thank you, Shelley and Jim, and good morning, and good morning to your audience. And I don't want to hijack your show. I just wanted to take this moment. I've been listening to the interview, and I think it's clear that to anybody that's listening, what an amazing advocate Jim Reed was for me and for my family, to the point that, you know, he went so far above and beyond what anybody could expect, that, like, he's literally become a member of our family, fighting a fight on our behalf, which he has failed to mention was, done without pay. Like, Jim has been in this fight for 15 years and has not been paid. Anybody out there who wants an amazing, amazing, brilliant attorney ought to call Jim Reed at Udall Shumway and get him on the phone, because he is, the guy's a pit bull. I'm telling you now, if you're on the other side of him, you do not want to tangle with Jim Reed.
Yeah, you know,
I think I just got paid.
I saw a photograph of you, both of you. In fact, we're going to be putting it on our website. And you kind of look like the odd couple.
Fair.
But I understand that, you know, just from talking to Jim prior to the show, that this was not his wheelhouse. He actually practiced in a different law field and took this on because he was so passionate and believed you about what was going on.
Yeah, I think it goes to the brilliance of Jim Reed, is that this was not his specialty. This was not his area of expertise. And he had to come up to speed and then be prepared to compete on the highest legal stage against the most powerful law firm on the planet, which is the Department of Justice.
Yes.
And at many times, it was a one-man show. It was Jim Reed against teams of specialized DOJ attorneys that, like, and when I say teams, I'm talking about dozens of attorneys working on the case against Jim Reed alone, and he held his ground and, in most cases, won the battles, like standing alone, which
that's huge.
He is absolutely a brilliant, brilliant attorney.
But yeah. Let me jump in on that, because I've told people, and Richard Rellis has done several great reps for the Arizona Republic on this case. I've told people there was a second attorney on this, and that was Jay. He was working his job full-time at ATF. I was working my other cases at my law firm. So we just had to fit in a full-out fight with DOJ, both kind of in our spare time. And as Jay said, I mean, it would be dozens of attorneys who have appeared on these pleadings over the last 10, 15 years at DOJ. And what happened the first couple of years, I didn't know what was going on in this case. I didn't know the facts of the case. I didn't know any of these players. And so for these depositions, Jay would show up with a box of documents, and he would just pull them out, and it would just be a stack, and I would watch him over the course of an hour just spread them out on long conference tables, some out in Phoenix, some in Washington, D.C., at White & Case, whose offices we were using. And 90 minutes later, they would be in this incredibly organized fashion. You know, you could see the way – it was like watching a geometry problem get solved. And then he would draft out questions for this. And sometimes, given limited time, I was reading these deposition questions on the airplane, you know, en route to D.C. And these were, you know, amazingly detailed questions. And then, you know, there's room in there for me to chase the rabbits down the hole. And sometimes I added some questions in on my own beforehand, and sometimes I just didn't need to. And then somewhere along the line, we did about 25 depositions in this case, somewhere along the line, I got it. And I started to really understand the case and what these guys were about. And as Jay, as you'll recall, for me, it might have been the deposition of George Gillette.
You know, I'll tell you, like, in the big picture of this, in spite of the heartache, in spite of some of the abuse, I look back now on it, like, this was, the entire event was truly a blessing in my life. And, like, the greatest blessing is that my association with Jim and the friendship and the trust and the loyalty I developed with Jim. And if I had to forfeit my relationship with Jim in exchange for not having to go through some of this pain, I would not do that. My trust and my love for Jim far outweighs the pain and suffering that we and me and my family experienced, because I would not trade being able to avoid that in exchange for not having Jim Reed in our life.
That's pretty powerful.
And I'm honored, Jay. Thank you for saying that. Yeah. And I feel the same way. And Jay, you know, he was at my mother's funeral. He was a pallbearer. What can you say?
Yeah, your family members, there's no doubt. And it's that makes me happy for you guys, but it kind of makes me sad that that brotherhood didn't come from the ATF, the federal agencies, that, you know, because there is a brotherhood there. And it sounds like you were so good at your job, Jay, that, you know, other people probably, oh, I could have done that, but maybe deep down, no, they could not have done that. You really had to get into character to do what you did.
Well, you know what? That's flattering, and thank you for that. I appreciate that, and Jim has always been very flattering of me. I was far from perfect. I made mistakes. I did things that I regretted. I wasn't the best investigator. I wasn't the best undercover agent. What I did do is I did everything every day as hard as I could do it. Some days I was successful, some days I failed. And that That is a threat to certain people, like people that conduct themselves with that attitude. Some people feel threatened by that on this job. And you know what? But I wasn't going to change for them. I was not going to change my attitude or change how I felt the job should be done to pacify people who wanted me to sit at my desk and push paper. I was never going to be that guy. And so, yeah, did I create enemies? Man, I did. I created a lot of enemies. And I don't feel good about that, but I wouldn't change it either.
Well, that speaks volumes right there, because in order to do your job effectively, you have to be that person. And
well, and I think, you know, and me and Jim have had this conversation many times throughout my career, through some of the dangerous events, then through some of these legal dilemmas we've had. We truly have had the hand of God on our shoulder, and we tried to stay on the high road. We did not cheat. We did not cut corners. We were the victims of cheating. We were the victims of corruption. We were the victims of incompetence and things that were illegal. And like, we constantly reminded ourselves, like, to stay on the right path, win or lose, we were going to do it with integrity. And we maintained that. We did not deviate from that plan.
And if I can, Sherry, can I give a quick example?
Sure.
Yeah, when ATF, the Department of Justice attorneys assigned to represent ATF, absolutely lied to Judge Allegra and said that these Internal Affairs Division reports were not relevant to the lawsuit, even though they became a cornerstone of the opinion, absolutely misrepresented that to a federal judge. And we proved it. And Judge Allegra was a pretty fierce federal judge. He said to us, "What do you guys want me to do about this? You know, do you want heads to roll?" And this was coming from Jay. The answer was, "We're going to leave it in the judge's hands. What we want is justice. What we want to do is to win." And those lawyers walked away from absolutely lying to a federal judge about critical, relevant evidence regarding what is, frankly, what we believe, a criminal obstruction of justice.
Absolutely.
When you get in the way and you derail a criminal arson investigation, and then there's a report about that, and you lie to a federal judge about that, there should be repercussions. Jay let them off on that. And that was basically how merciful he was to these people during this case.
It sounds like they deliberately contaminated the FBI's case as well by misrepresenting things.
Jay?
Yeah, I absolutely they did. And here's what happened. In a nutshell, I ran into a perfect storm of corruption, incompetence, and institutional arrogance. And when you bring those three things together, it's very dangerous. It's not just dangerous for Jay Dobbins. It's dangerous for us. It's dangerous for us as the public.
Right.
That the people that we trust to go out and investigate and protect us and represent the law and all these moral and ethical attitudes that we have, when they are completely abandoned for personal reasons, that goes far beyond the danger to me. It's a danger to all of us.
That's true. I mean, if we can't trust the people who are out there protecting us, who can we trust? So
maybe I can put a cap on this then, because Sherry, as you know, we won the trial. Jay was awarded damages, proved that ATF acted in bad faith. The Federal Circuit Court of Appeals reversed on a very nuanced legal ground and admitted that the agreement was about Jay's safety, admitted that bad conduct had occurred that was, you know, not in compliance with our expectations. And we petitioned to the U.S. Supreme Court, and a few weeks ago they denied our petition. So what's left from all this, and Jay and I talk about this all the time, we think there has to have been a sea change at ATF and maybe even at the FBI as to how agents are treated. How they're treated in employment negotiations, how they're treated with respect to their safety, EEO complaints. The idea that somehow this case wasn't heard and didn't ricochet all through the Department of Justice, that agents will stand up against their agencies if their safety and the safety of their families' lives are compromised, that did resonate. That did make a difference, we believe. And, you know, if that's the legacy of J. Dobbins' career at the very end, I think it's one that he's satisfied with. It's not one that he saw coming, but maybe the best thing he could do for these other agents was to stand apart from them for a little while.
Was he allowed to, Jay, you're on the phone, were you allowed to retire?
I did. I retired. They did everything they could to force me out, but I was determined to retire on my terms. I was not going to let them push me out the door or trick me out the door. I went on my terms. I went when after our trial court work was completed. And regardless of what happened beyond that, we won at the trial court. All those allegations that we made, we proved those before a federal judge who agreed with our arguments. And so the victory is not a hollow victory. It's not a shallow victory because it was taken away by a higher court over a technical issue. The arguments we made, the allegations we made, we proved. And we proved not to a civil level, to a criminal level, beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah, I can see that, though. It was pretty significant.
And all anyone has to do to read that opinion is Google J. Dobbins Court of Federal Claims or J. Dobbins 2014 Trial Court Opinion. And all those findings of fact are in a published opinion that is never going away.
So did the movie come out? Is there a movie?
You know what? Hollywood is a trippy place, man. I'll tell you. It's a very difficult sea to navigate. So it's in the works. It's been talked about off and on. But to come back, like, very quickly, I think the people that were fighting us tried to create the illusion that this was all about money and that J. Dobbins and Jim Reed were suing the government because they were trying to get rich. This was never about money. There's a monetary element. There's a component to it.
30 seconds.
The courts force you to claim a monetary element. It was never about that. It was about truth and justice, and that's where it will always be.
Well, I want to thank both of you for coming on and talking about the backside of this story. It's very intriguing. I think we could have gone on for another hour. And I want to ask everybody, go to lawmatters1030.org and check out our GoFundMe page. Until next week, thank you, Jay. Thank you, Jim. Shop local. Stay safe.